work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated.
Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart, and that was Amy Bell you just heard, our trainee engineer and new co-host. Well, she's not too new anymore as a co-host, but she's new as an engineer. And we're phasing out Joe Henderson. He's back there with her. And thank you, Joe, for the times you've come in here so loyally and helped us on the board. And you've been a really good sport. And we said that we were trying to get it back to an all-woman show because, largely sometimes we get out on topics that are maybe embarrassing for men because you know how women are when we get together. But today we have two women, businesswomen from downtown Overland Park as our guests. First we have the manager of 10,000 Villages, Kendra Frink. And she can tell you a little bit about 10,000 Villages when we get started. And then our second interview is with Jean McKay of the Tasteful Olive. And I understand that she was named Entrepreneur of the Year by the Kansas Chamber of Commerce. So we'll have a lot to talk with about her, especially about the healthful effects of good olive oil. And Amy can attest to that. So let's get started with Kendra. Kendra Frink, manager of 10,000 Villages for 3.5 years. How did you come to take that job?
Sure. Well, I had been very involved in the fair trade movement when I was a student, actually, at Kansas State University. So it was quite a while ago, and I had remained involved in the fair trade movement. It always interested me. It was something I was always passionate about. And I was actually a volunteer at the store. I had another job and learned that Linda Zemke, the former manager, was retiring, and I applied for the job, and here I am today.
Well, there you go. And I know there are a lot of passionate volunteers. I don't know how many employees you have, but I know you have a lot of volunteers and are always, I think, on the lookout for more volunteers to help. Tell us a little bit about the concept, 10,000 Villages. What's that about?
Sure. Well, we are a fair trade retail store. We have things in the store that were produced by artisans from about 36 developing countries. The artisans were paid a fair wage for making the items. And 10,000 Villages has been around since 1946. Our store has been in Overland Park for the past 13 years. And as a fair trade organization, we work directly with the artisan groups, you know, helping them with various aspects of their businesses and ensuring that they're paid a fair wage, you know, ensuring environmental sustainability in the production of the items. As a store network, we have about 84 stores all over the United States.
And you said also, though, that 10,000 Villages did distribute to other outlets, so you're really getting those goods out there that are made largely, I understand, by women.
Yes, we really are. Right now, I think 10,000 Villages has products in about 390 retail outlets in total in the United States. There's also 10,000 Villages Canada, which is selling products throughout Canada and store networks there. And yes, we really broadened the network. And you mentioned female artisans. Right now, it's about 70% of our artisans that are female.
I traveled to Thailand about 20 years ago and excited I'm going to go to India this year, this coming year, in fact, New Year's Eve. And I love the handicraft that they do. And to find a country is so dependent upon the handcrafts of the women, it seems like, that is just a major, major mover of the economy for the women in these countries. Am I correct along that? Or?
Right. Handicrafts, particularly in India, but in a lot of countries, they're very important. And a lot of the things that we have in the store, they're traditional cultural crafts. They're things that sometimes they've been producing in those countries for thousands of years. And so we want to ensure that those cultural crafts remain an art form and are available to the public. And so part of what we do is, you know, we have this network of retail outlets where the product is sold. And part of fair trade is giving market access to these artisans that otherwise would wouldn't have that market access. I mean, you know, as a tourist in India, you're there and you're able to purchase items, but through fair trade, we have a whole network in the United States and through the entire fair trade movement through Europe and Australia, and fair trade, even the consumption of fair trade products is growing in developing countries as well.
Well, I was in there, I think, November 3rd for a fundraiser that, in fact, the woman that I will be traveling to India with works for a nonprofit, and you guys set up for nonprofits to have a day to invite people to come in, and then you give back to the nonprofit a percentage of the sales for that day. And it's just mind-blowing to go in there and to look at the things and, like, oh my gosh, how do I make a decision? I did notice that several things I was drawn to. I bought a tablecloth that was from India, and I can't remember. I found a mirror that was really lovely too, but I don't remember where it was from. But the vast array of items in there are just mind-boggling, and the prices range from very low to, saw one thing that I really liked that was pretty expensive. You know that white beaded piece that you
yes,
got?
That's a very special piece. That piece is, it's a mirror from South Africa, hand beaded, and that mirror is part of our Traveler's Find program. So those are really specific items that come from artisan groups that make very, very specialty items. We have a few of those items in the store right now, some mud cloth, and some lost wax statues that are beautiful, and then the mirror. And so those are special items. We are one of, I believe, 12 10,000 Villages stores in the country that carries those items. So you won't find them in all of our stores, just a few.
And I love mud cloth, too. That's something I've been collecting. Mm-hmm. I may need to come back in and look at that because I missed it when I was in there that day. So how many employees do you have, and how, I've got lots of questions, how do you find this? Who's your buyer? Who's, how do you know what kind of merchandise you'll be getting? And can you just kind of answer some of those questions?
Sure. Well, you already kind of mentioned that we are largely a volunteer-based organization. We have a small number of paid staff, 4 paid staff, and then we have about 65 volunteers who assist with various things in the store. You know, any given day when you come into the store, probably the sales associate who greets you at the store is a volunteer. So, you know, they assist with that. There's also volunteers who just help us unpack shipments and do those types of things as well. And then our board of directors, obviously, are all volunteers. So there's various volunteer roles within our organization. As far as purchasing the items, through 10,000 Villages, that happens at our main office, which is in Akron, Pennsylvania. So there's 5 buyers, and they work in different world regions. They work directly with the artisan groups, with our purchasing department and our design department there to purchase from those artisans. Right now we're purchasing from about 110 artisan groups. And so the buyers work directly with those groups. We have other items in our store from other fair trade vendors, which since I manage the inventory, I seek out different fair trade wholesalers and vendors that we can also add to supplement the products in our store.
For example,
some, like Global Mamas, for instance, that is a cooperative out of Ghana, West mm-hmm, Africa. Mm-hmm. Minga Fair Trade, they do a lot of fair trade in Central and South America. We have a lot of products from them. Also, the coffee that we get from Equal Exchange and from Level Ground Trading. So those are just some of the other vendors that we work with as well.
And the chocolate?
The chocolate, yes, from Equal Exchange and Divine. Equal Exchange grown primarily in the Dominican Republic, the cacao, and then Divine being from Ghana.
I bought some chocolate also. I just remembered. I forgot it's in the freezer. I'll remember that
you
when I go home.
You should have brought it to share.
I know.
I do have a question, though. How do you determine what fair trade is? What are you, is that based on what the kind of currency value of a country is, or what? How does that get determined? How does it get qualified as fair trade?
Sure. Well, as a fair trade organization, we've pledged to uphold the 9 principles that are the backbone of fair trade. One of those being a fair wage, then also environmental sustainability, ensuring no child labor was used in the production of the items, working with marginalized producer groups, so those types of things. As far as a fair wage, that wage at 10,000 Villages is determined in negotiation with the artisan group and with 10,000 Villages, considering things such as you know, the wages in the local context. So it is a fair wage in the local context for the artisan that produced it. But it's a wage that ensures that everyone involved in the process of creating that item was paid a fair wage. So a good example of that are like some scarves that we have from Laos. The organization Fontong Handicrafts that makes those scarves, not only does the artisan group weave that scarf, they are also the ones who actually raise the silkworms and harvest the silk. So we want to be sure that everyone involved in that process was paid a fair wage. We also consider, you know, the skill and the amount of time it takes to produce an item. So the artisan has a voice in setting that price, which is not always the case in traditional trade.
Right. And what about the marginalized groups? We talked about there being women, and I know in a lot of countries women are marginalized, but that's not just women that you're talking about with marginalized groups. What kind of experience do you have with who's the marginalized groups?
Sure. Well, women are marginalized in a lot of the countries, but also persons with disabilities who otherwise would not be able to find employment. We do have several groups that we purchase from who consist entirely of persons with disabilities. And other groups that would otherwise just not have a market for their crafts. And in a lot of countries, that could be geographical. They just don't have access to consumers to be able to sell their product.
That's just fantastic, yeah.
If many countries probably don't have the tourism, for example, a large part of our trip to Thailand turned out to be they expected us to spend money while we were there. It was through the Missouri Division Extension. It's been so long ago, and just kind of a back and forth thing, and they would come here one year, and Missouri women would go there, but largely they took us around so that we had plenty of opportunities to buy their goods.
Right. So I actually did an internship. One of the groups I mentioned earlier, Global Mamas, that works in Ghana. I had an opportunity. I was very fortunate to be able to do an internship with them a few years ago. So I worked with a group of women that were making these beautiful beads out of recycled glass. We have some of them in the store. And, you know, they just really, without fair trade, they had such limited options to be able to sell them. You know, I was a person living there for a couple of months, and I just thought to myself, the opportunities are so limited for these women to be able to sell their beads. You know, there's a couple of markets they could have gone to be able to sell them, but first of all, you have to be able to get booth space at those markets to even be able to sell the beads. Second of all, you have to travel to them. And a lot of times, you know, they're talking about a 100-pound bag of beads that they want to be able to take just to show the selection of their products. And, you know, they don't have cars, so being able to take public transportation a couple of hours just to get to that market to even sell their products and then hope that there might be tourists or locals there that day who are willing to purchase them. So there were just a lot of barriers for them to be able to sell their product.
So you said you had about 36 countries that you dealt with. Are those markets always opening up, or what is the opportunity there?
Right now, another large part of fair trade is maintaining long-term relationships with the artisan groups that we work with. So right now, 10,000 Villages, in order to be able to maintain those relationships of the artisan groups that we are working with, we aren't expanding to new artisan groups right now because we want to maintain that commitment to the groups that we are working with. However, groups are always welcome to submit, you know, their product ideas and their samples to 10,000 Villages, and there's information on the website as to how they're able to do that. Because there is a lot of need out there. There's a lot of artisan groups making fantastic things, and fair trade is really a growing movement. And more, there's a lot of organizations that can help some of those groups that are working in country. The World Fair Trade Organization is another great overarching international organization that can help a lot of those artisan groups.
Did you have another question, Amy?
Yeah, I did. I was wondering, when you enter into a fair trade agreement with some of these artisans, are you giving them enough business for that to be one of the only people they're making it for, or are they wound up getting stuck into not so good a deals with other people searching to buy their product as well?
Well, one of our organizational goals is to be able to work with these artisan groups to give them information about the market. We want them to know, and we want them to actually think about when they're selling their products, what their products are worth, so that they really know the market value. The reason for that is we want them to sell to lots of vendors. We don't want them to sell just to 10,000 villages. We want them to sell to conventional buyers, fair trade buyers alike, but be able to have access to that market information, that they know what their product is worth, and that's what they're bringing to the negotiating table with those other buyers as well.
So you're not just giving them a gift of more money. You're giving them the tools to negotiate on a level playing field with some of the people that maybe just know better what the market value of their product is.
So our mission statement as an organization is to create opportunities for artisans in developing countries to earn income, because we want them to have, we want it to be a sustainable solution, and it is a sustainable solution the way that it works, because, you know, they have access to this information and they know what their product is worth, and it helps their businesses to be able to grow, to sell to a lot of different vendors.
It's kind of interesting. I think we talked about this before we went on the air, that this was formed in 1946 by a woman. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Edna Ruth Byler is the founder of 10,000 Villages, and her story is very interesting. She was living in Puerto Rico. She saw women there who were producing these beautiful hand-embroidered handkerchiefs and other linens. But again, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, those women, they just didn't have a lot of outlets to sell those products. You know, maybe there were tourists on the street, a very limited number, and they were able to sell a few, but they were putting forth all of this effort, making these beautiful crafts, and they just didn't have access to markets to be able to sell them. So what she did was she bought up a whole lot of these handkerchiefs, brought them back to the United States. She started selling them out of the trunk of her car. She started selling them out of her garage to women at her church, to anyone that she could find. And that's how 10,000 Villages was born.
That is amazing. And I think women are amazing overall as a whole. What do we call women anyway? A whole subset, 50% of the population, women are totally amazing. And especially the things that they do and the concern they have, I think with welfare of a community and the children and the families, and that this woman took that upon herself to do that in 1946.
And what I like about this concept is that it's not a charity. It's not, let's have the West come in and save these poor people that can't take care of themselves. It's, let's go in there and give them the actual value for what they do, because these people are talented artists. I've mm-hmm. seen this work, and it's just, sometimes it just leaves you breathless. It's just a human hands made this. This wasn't a machine. And it's just to give them the tools to negotiate. It's not, they're still doing a lot of hard work to make all these things. They're not getting taken care of. They're just have somebody looking out for their interests and helping them get what they need, what they deserve for what they do.
Well, why don't you tell us what your website is, your business hours, where you're located, and all of that information?
Sure. Our store-specific website is overlandpark.10,000villages.com. The national website is 10,000villages.com, and you can find information on both of those sites. And we are at 7947 Santa Fe Drive in Overland Park. And so that's right at the corner of 80th and Santa Fe Drive there, just right off of Metcalf. And we are open Monday through Wednesday and Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Thursday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then Saturday, 9 to 5. And we are open on Sundays to the holiday season through the December 22nd from 1 to 5.
And any groups out there that want to perhaps utilize the what do you call that program that you do with charitable organizations?
Those are our community shopping events. And so we do, you know, you've already touched on it a little bit, but we give 15% of net sales to those partner organizations. And we typically do those during the holiday season. So if a group is interested in that, they're welcome to contact me or to come into the store, call the store. And we're happy to talk with them about that program.
And that season will be, it's closed this year, but it'll be open again next holiday season, so...
Yes. So if they contact me as soon as possible, we'll get them on the list of organizations to send out that information to next year.
Okay, so it's not too early to contact you. In fact, it's just
right. Sure, yes. Contact me for 2014 now.
Great.
Right.
Oh, thank you so much, Kendra. Frank.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
For being our guest today and sharing information about 10,000 Villages and the crafts and the work that you're doing and helping to enable people in other countries to earn a decent wage or a fair wage. It's a struggle for women all over the world to get a fair pay for fair work. So that's amazing. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
And we've got some messages, and we'll be back.
Tune in Monday morning at 9 a.m. for Jaws of Justice Radio. Find out what the Veterans Administration is doing to address homelessness among veterans nationally and locally, and the Homeless Veterans Campus being built with the help of Catholic Charities. That's 9 a.m. Monday on Jaws of Justice Radio, right after Democracy Now!
And we're back, and now we're going to have Jean McKay, and she is from The Tasteful Olive, which is also in downtown Overland Park, and it is actually right next door to 10,000 Villages. And Jean's story struck me as very interesting because you actually were awarded this year, it was this year, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Was it the woman business owner?
Well, it's a very specific name of the award, and it's through the Kansas Department of Commerce, and it's called the Kansas Women and Minority-Owned Business. And they do this every year, and they select 16 winners, 8 on the women-owned side and 8 on the minority-owned side. And so in the retail category, the Tasteful Olive and myself received the Kansas Women Owned Business of the Year Award.
Well, that's just fantastic. So what was your journey to winning this award? Did you have to submit something, or did they just find you because you were doing so well?
Well, I tell you, there's lots of awards out there, and sometimes you have to maybe even nominate yourself, but this particular one I had to be nominated for. So someone from the Overland Park Chamber of Commerce did the nomination, and then he interviewed me, and we had to send in to them a lot of paperwork.
What has this done for you as a business owner to kind of have this validation of this, I am woman and I am roaring with my business?
Well, that's a unique way to put it. I hadn't thought of it that way. I guess I felt pretty humbled and honored. You know, I wasn't expecting to be a winner. I was very surprised and happy. I don't know that I felt any extra strength or anything, but I felt like, wow, really this is good because people are noticing the store and noticing what we have in the store, and that's what makes someone be an award winner.
That's just, you know, when you get down to it, I think that's a business owner thing to say. They like my product, and that's, you know, I think that's what a business owner wants to see. Is this your first business?
This is my first business for me, myself, without my husband's, added efforts. He helps me out once in a while, but it's mainly my store, and it's kind of a unique thing for me because I've always, since we've been married, been an entrepreneur along with him. But now this was my chance, and this was like, wow, I can do this.
Was it kind of intimidating to step off into that by yourself, or were you?
It was.
Yeah.
I think when I got the key to the facility that the store is in, my husband looked at me and he said, I said to him, gee, I don't know if I can do this. And he looked at me and he said, well, you better decide because they're waiting inside to give you the key to the place. So I had to finally say, okay, this is it. I'm doing it.
Excellent. Well, we're glad that you did because I have been there and it's a little bit different. How did you come to just an olive oil store?
Well, everything in my life is a story, Amy. You know, I just... I just have to say that I knew about olive oil when I was a little girl, but I knew about it because my mother used to put it in my ear for an earache. Yes, because she had this little Pompeii bottle of olive oil sitting in the cupboard, and every time one of us kids would have an earache, she'd heat up that olive oil, put a little cotton ball in it, stick it in the ear, and then lay me down on the couch with a heating pad or a warm washcloth over that.
Did that work?
I would go to sleep because it felt so soothing and wake up without an earache.
Oh, my word. And you're talking about stuff that maybe they would give antibiotics for now.
Right.
You stuck
right.
a cotton ball soaked in olive oil in your ear. I love that.
So there you go. So there's the first thing about owning an olive oil store that has fresh olive oils is it is so good for our health in many ways, not just in consumption, but olive oil has very healing properties. For instance, if you would rub regular olive oil on your skin, it actually soaks into your cellular structure. It doesn't stay on the outside of your skin as a surface lotion. It soaks in. And it has healing properties. It's actually anti-inflammatory. So you can use olive oil. A daily dose is recommended. And you don't have to probably take maybe aspirin or Tylenol. If you are on a daily regimen, you can use olive oil to do a Mediterranean diet, which is highly recommended now in both the other side of the world and ours, to stay on a Mediterranean diet for healthful properties of good natural foods. And of course, olive oil comes from the olives, which is a fruit. So when it's freshest, it's best because that's when the healthy benefits are in the olive oil.
Well, I have to say, I can see where your passion for something like this would, I mean, naturally, you should have opened an olive oil store. What else could you have done? This is just such a passionate subject, and I just love hearing you talk about it.
What is a Mediterranean diet? And I'm envisioning that we take a tablespoon of olive oil every day.
Mm-hmm. 2 tablespoons a day is actually recommended for heart health. But one of the tricks of the trade is, and in anything we do in trying to eat healthier, is give up the bad stuff in your diet, too, along with consuming the good stuff. So, you want to use olive oil instead of other oils. Coconut oil has also very beneficial health properties. Coconut oil as well, 3 tablespoons a day on that. And get it wherever you can. On your toast in the morning for coconut oil, same way with olive oil. Coconut oil for sautéing those little shrimp that you like so much, and put a little maybe real butter or olive oil, buttered flavor olive oil in it. And you can just do these products so easily.
So are you a bit of a chef, too? Because I'm just hearing something.
Oh, I'd like to say that I am or could be, but basically I just create easy ways to use the olive oils and our vinegars as well. Because sometimes people come into the store and they say, you know, I got a bottle of olive oil last year. You know, is it still good? What do I do with it? I haven't opened it. And we're saying, wow, you need to open that olive oil and use it now, because after a year it's going to be growing non-fresh. So you want to use it while it's the freshest. So we give them easy ideas. And there's so many in the store and our recipes. And we educate our staff so that we all educate ourselves. We research so that we can tell customers really healthy and easy ways to use the products.
That sounds like the type of eating that I like to do is, you know, the fast, easy, and also healthy, just as added bonus. Mm-hmm. I want it to be super quick, super easy, and not having to, you know, run and get fast food either. So it's kind of hard to get those quick meals.
And I still want to hang back to that. What does Mediterranean diet mean?
Mediterranean diet would simply mean your, of course, raw vegetables and raw fruits. No sugars added. Healthy oils added. It would be whole grains. Stay away from processed foods. Highly processed foods, not recommended at all. Stay away from even your white processed salt is not as good as you think it is when you pull it off the shelf at 39 cents a box like I used to when I was younger. Now I think the price has changed now, but we used to get a box of iodized salt you know, for 39 cents a box. And it's like, that's all the salt I knew. Now I have sea salts, very natural, healthy sea salts. Mediterranean diet also includes, of course, good beverages, good nutrition and hydration also, and daily intake of what you need, of the number of vegetable servings, the number of fruit servings, the number of whole grains, the number of dairy products. Now, some of these products you can't have because you're on a special regimen of diet from your doctor. Some people come in and say, I'm not supposed to do any grains anymore, no bread, no carbs. I'm not supposed to do any dairy foods, so I'm looking at olive oil and vinegar. What can I do with these products?
And what are some of the things that they can do besides salads, for example?
Oh, and that's the first thing people think of. Let's do a vinaigrette. Let's just do it with an oil and a vinegar. You don't have any extra additives other than natural stuff. And that's perfect because there's 60 oils and vinegars in our store. So you can have limitless combinations for salad dressings, but some other easy uses would be your balsamics, for instance, which come from Italy, and they're made from the white Trebbiano grape that only grows there, and then they're aged 12 to 18 years in wooden barrels, so they're the real thing. I like to use balsamic vinegar to sweeten something, therefore getting rid of white processed sugar in my diet. So we sweeten hot oatmeal in the morning with it. We add balsamic vinegar to a fruit smoothie. How delicious. We do it a little over cheesecake or ice cream when we choose to do desserts. Mm-hmm. You can also use it as a glaze for meat. So when you're grilling or when you're baking your meat, just last 5 or 10 minutes, just brush a little balsamic vinegar. It'll form a glaze and give wonderful flavor to the meat. You can also use a little zing of that balsamic on top of a roasted veggie just to give that little extra perk to vegetables that you sometimes don't like to eat as much as fruits and other things. So let's do some good things with both oil and vinegar there, too.
This is making me really hungry.
Let's go to eat. You ready?
I know. I do. I want to have it to be healthy and
sweet. Did
vinegar.
I hear Amy say that you did a cooking class this morning?
I actually was partnering with Olathe North High School Culinary. The executive chef there is Mike Krystowski. And during the farmer's market in the summer, they asked me if I want to have a chef come and do a farmer's kitchen series. And I chose to do it two times this year. So I interested his group, his students, to come and do something made with our oil and vinegar, and it could be sampled out to people who are at the market today. So they did a butternut squash soup with our pomegranate balsamic vinegar. Oh my.
Oh, my.
And
Lord.
Little
and
pomegranate seeds
students?
In it. High school students.
Oh.
Yes.
So when are they going to have their restaurant opening up? Because
oh,
I'm
my goodness. They already have a cafe in the school. So,
really?
It is. I'm not sure if theirs is once a month or every week.
So how long have you been volunteering this help with the high school? Is this something?
Well, it's a new partnering type thing. As chefs have gotten to know the Tasteful Olive and our fine products, and I've joined the Chefs Association, a lot of chefs are just coming up and saying, hey, my group would like to do something with your oils and vinegars. What can we do? So we come up with ideas, and they say, well, we'd like to use your oils and vinegars in our competitions we go to. And this group did last year, and they went all the way to national. Two of their menu items had our products in them. The Broadmoor Bistro is the cafe run by the Broadmoor Technical High School Culinary as well, and we're partnering with them as well. So it's really a cool partnering situation as more and more people find out about the fine quality of our oils and vinegars.
And I think people are beginning to want to learn to eat more wholesomely and clean food without the GMOs and the additives and the processing. And I suspect that you notice that in your store, probably business picking up because people are learning about you.
More and more people are coming in saying that their cardiologist or their doctor recommended they switch to a Mediterranean diet or at least switch their oils to olive oil. And of course, when they taste the balsamics, they are.
I think we actually have a caller. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And could you state your name and where you're calling from?
This is Donna calling from north of the river.
And what would you like to ask our guest today, Donna?
Well, I just tuned in, but I didn't hear your guest talk about cooking vessels, the types of things that we use to prepare our food in. I was wondering if she had an opinion on Teflon and aluminum and those types of cooking vessels and the effects that they have on our health.
Absolutely.
And Donna, I trust you will be here shortly.
I'm on my way, Sharon.
Okay, we'll see you. And I guess you want to take the answer off the air? She's gone. Okay. Yeah, answer her.
Okay,
yeah.
So I guess for me, I like a really high-quality nonstick cookware to work with. My husband, on the other hand, loves to use the old-fashioned black skillet. And then every time we use it, we reseal it with more oil in the pan.
Is it tempering it?
Yes, so temper, seal it so that, you know, it holds its finish and everything.
Season it. Yeah, we cook with cast iron at my house.
Okay,
and,
right, cast iron, that's it. I couldn't think of the name.
And
yep.
it is supposed to be less toxic than the Teflons and stuff like that. And
there's a new green pan out that's very good.
I have used one of those, and I do like it. But that cast iron kind of
there's
gives
something
a nice,
about it.
I don't know, a nice... You make up some good peasant food.
Yeah,
kind of like,
right. And you can bake in that old black cast iron, too, so you can do that as well. So I recommend either. It doesn't really matter. What matters is the oil you use. And extra virgin olive oils shouldn't be used for very, very high cooking, like for frying. You don't want to fry chicken in an extra virgin. That does deteriorate the freshness of the oil and the flavor, and also as it defreshens, olive oil will lose a lot of its healthful properties.
That's what I was going to ask, is those, mm-hmm. those cast iron skillets mm-hmm. can get very hot. Is it dangerous to get that olive oil too hot for that?
It could be. You just want to go a medium to medium high heat if you're looking at, you know, your little knob on the
mm-hmm.
stove. Or just to make sure that oil doesn't smoke in the pan. You don't want any oil to smoke, actually, because it does deteriorate our oils. Now, when I talk about fresh olive oil, though, I mean ours are so fresh that no matter what country they come from, the olives have been picked and then pressed into oil within 3 to 4 hours of picking. That's fresh olive oil. That's as if you were standing at the grove doing your harvest with them, and they tell you to wash up for lunch, and you're going to drink that oil that you just helped harvest the olives of. That's where the best health benefits come from and the best flavor comes from.
My mouth is watering. I really love these olive oil cooking. And we do some olive oil cooking. This is one of my favorite recipes we do. It's kind of like an eggplant parmesan spin. Instead of frying an eggplant, we do a really good fried eggplant parmesan, but we just take some like zucchini and some yellow squash and maybe some other vegetables, and we just baste them in olive oil and put a little marinara sauce and a little bit of mozzarella cheese on it, and it's just this really, it tastes almost like you're having a eggplant parmesan or one of those that's much greasier and much worse for you to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that on some spaghetti, and it's just one of my favorite things to eat.
I am getting hungry, too.
Yeah, I just had to throw in one of my favorite olive oil.
You know,
oil
I want to get back to, I think what I just understood you to say, that the freshness of olive oil comes from the picking to the getting it into the oil, because you said the oils are then aged.
No, that's balsamic vinegar.
Oh, the balsamic
vinegar. Yeah, that's a different thing.
Thank you.
Olive
okay.
oil needs to be fresh to have its all extreme
okay.
health benefits.
So it's picked, and how fast do you get it into the shelves then?
Well, actually, because I've chosen to have one supplier of all the olive oils and all the vinegars, if an olive oil is unflavored, they don't touch that after that other than having it tested to its highest standards of extra virgin. Extra virgin is the top layer of olive oil.
What does that mean?
That means that it is the best olive oil you can buy is extra virgin, 100% extra virgin. But ours go farther than that. They're tested in 10 different testing ways to make sure they have all and even higher standards than the International Olive Council. So there's a standard across the whole world as to extra virgin and what it should be defined as. First of all, it's supposed to be olives from the olive tree. Ha, ha, ha. Sometimes you may find that it says on the back of your label that refined oils have been added. That could mean a lower grade quality of olive oil or a nut or seed oil has been added. we don't have very good monitoring standards here in the United States.
And you
States.
Might not even know what
you
other
do not
oil
know. They
is.
Won't tell you exactly what all of it is, or if it's been tested, or if it can be tested, or if refined oils and what they are have been added.
Oh, I just don't like how they can do that with our food.
Now, Europe is different. They have very high standards, and you can't get by with selling commercially unless it's it says it is.
I wish I knew more about this, but I'm thinking some state just kind of voted on something that was supposed to be impactful on the whole of the country if this state passed this GMO.
California was voting on the GMO thing, but I don't know if that would even help this inserting a different product. Do they use GMO olives? Is that something? I mean, because if this is coming from Europe, they don't really do that over there, do they?
Well, it depends upon knowing your own growers. So we trust our supplier who works with the olive groves or the olive producers directly. And they have to be tested in independent testing labs after the oil's been made to make sure it's tested to our supplier's highest standards. 10 different ways. Peroxide value level of an olive oil, for instance, when that's been tested, it shows what condition the fruit was in when it was picked and processed into oil. If you've had an insect bite into that olive, you hadn't thought of that before, had you? Or if there had a frost during the harvest, that can affect the olive and how it'll test or not test very good after it's been made into oil. You really don't want the olives to suffer a frost and then try to get the juice and the oil out of them afterwards.
Well, you know, the way you talk about olive oil, it makes it kind of surprising that people aren't having olive oil pairings like they do with fine wine and artisan beers, that they should be having these handcrafted olive oils and dip some bread mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite things to do with olive oil is dip some bread in it. That's really delicious.
And we do that at the store. We have classes every once in a while. About once every 2 months, we'll have a basic 101 O&V course. So you can learn all about olive oil industry. It's growing, it's picking, it's harvesting, it's processing into oil, the balsamic vinegars and their age, naturally flavored, and where they come from, and everything. And then we have the pairings. And then we go through, wow, different, unique, popular ones that people love over and over again, as well as new ones that customers show us every day.
Oh, yeah. Just, it seems like the possibilities get endless when you're doing cooking, stuff like that. It's very exciting. So do you get to travel to go visit these?
I travel by internet.
Oh, well, that's not as much fun as hopping over to Italy.
Yes, and I had planned a trip this year, and it just didn't work out time-wise and with my personal schedule, but I do a lot of research, and our own supplier has olive oil seminars that I've been out to twice now in California and met a lot of chefs out there that are using the products, and then we learn all about growing and harvesting and what really is the guts of learning about olives. And if you didn't know, if you hadn't been in our store, you'd kind of look kind of weird at some of the little talk cards, I call them, sitting by the fusties that the oil's in, especially for the unflavored, because they're named by the olive they come from. And then it tells what country it comes from. Right now we emphasize the Southern Hemisphere unflavored oils because they just harvested in May and June. After Christmas, we'll be able to get the Northern Hemisphere ones in, which are harvesting actually right now as we speak.
Where are Southern Hemisphere olive growers? I mean, I know about Northern Hemisphere olive growers, but where are the olives?
You didn't even know it before, and I didn't either before I got into this business. But missionaries and explorers brought olive trees all around the world as they traveled. So Australia is a big one. They've been winning awards with their olive oils for 7-8 years now, as well as their wines, which is neat to talk about, too. And also we have Chile represented and Argentina, South American oils. And now this season we've got some from Peru. All over the world, olive trees have been brought. Northern Hemisphere ones, of course, California has become a big one. They always have, but now they're very interested in making sure theirs are tested to their highest standards before they let other people buy them. And, of course, Italy, Spain, Greece, where in the Syrian region 6,000 years ago, the first olive tree was found good to be good for its fruit, and then it expanded from there.
That
Who knew?
I know.
I'm like, what?
No, I did not anticipate a discussion about olive oil to be so engaging. It's just exciting. I didn't know about the Southern Hemisphere olives. I didn't know about all of these cooking things you're doing with the high schools and whatnot. But one thing I really wanted to ask you, though, is what kind of advice could you give if there was another woman that was thinking, well, should I start a business? Do you recommend this life path?
I would say, generally speaking, I think yes. I think maybe Kendra, my next-door neighbor, might agree that strong women can do very strong things. I'm very fortunate that I had some entrepreneurial experience during my married life. I never considered myself an entrepreneur when I had my first 2 years of college. I got married and had kids right away. But I went back to college. I now have two associate's degrees. One's in travel and tourism, and the other one in general studies. So I've found myself wanting to be more well-rounded, educated, and also learn and be strong in who I am growing to be. So each year that the kids got older, and I have six kids and going on 14 grandchildren, so I've had a lot of domestic experience, gardening, for instance, which is Mediterranean diet, there you go. Helping my husband do self-employment endeavors, so I'd always do the business part, the shipping, the handling, the, you know, taking the money and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, you sound so very business savvy, but what you said is that you didn't go to school for business. You learned it in the real world. Mm-hmm. You got a practical education.
So therefore, any strong woman that feels she can handle multitask and do lots of things at one time, which what it is to run a store and handle your staff, be able to train and educate and keep good relationships going there, know when a good staff person needs to be kept on, and know when, well, I don't think they're doing so good for me. We need to see if they can go on to something else. Because I educate a lot.
That was the nicest euphemism for firing someone.
Well, if they're not a good fit, if they, you know, just aren't, you know, that energetic with the products, and, you know, and they realize they're just maybe not what they should be in promoting the products as well as we want them to, so.
No, it's absolutely excellent advice. Did you do work before being an entrepreneur?
Well, I would say I was, because I learned kind of a lot of those tips and techniques from my husband, who kind of always has been. He's always wanted to do things more or less on his own than work for someone, which I didn't feel bad about at all. So we just did things together.
I love
that. Isn't
it
great?
A good team.
It was a good teamwork, yeah.
I think a large part is to making up your mind you can do it and you will do it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a commitment. Yeah. You don't just say, well, I think I'll try this and maybe it'll work out. But you went into that when you took the keys. You know, your husband said, well, you better make up your mind. And I think that was good advice. Make up your mind now, because that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Sounds easy, but it isn't.
So did you wind up spending time at home with your kids first, or...?
Yes, they came along fairly quickly, one after the other, and so for a long time I just either helped him out with what we were doing together, or I did little part-time things. So I've got a little bit of a music background, so I was teaching piano lessons for a while, part-time work in a typesetting and printing shop. That was before word processing and computers, you know, so I did the layout and the typesetting, the big clunky machine. So I learned a lot about typing. I was always good at English, so I wrote well, so I was always kind of writing, typing, mailing, shipping, money, you know, the whole shebang. So I learned a lot of useful tools just by living, just by surviving.
Absolutely. Well, I teach piano lessons right now to, you know, I'm able to stay at home with my son, and sometimes this entrepreneurial thing is one of the best options when you have children to take care of, because that child care, it's not just the cost, it's the fact that you're not there raising your child, too. So I like hearing about a fellow music teacher person that's gone on to make this really fascinating store that it seems to be doing really well. Every time I've been in there, there are just a lot of people.
Did Amy's husband belongs to the chamber, right? The Overland Park Chamber?
No. He goes to the Overland Park, Merchants of Overland Park, their meeting. Merchant meeting.
And didn't you say that there are an amazing number of women-owned businesses in Overland Park, downtown Overland Park? And that's pretty interesting in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's really great. I mean, we were trying to count them before the show, how many of the businesses are women-owned, and even the ones that aren't only women-owned are kind of a husband and wife team, a lot of them are. But there's just some great women that have gotten these ideas of these, you know, I love olive oil, and here's this delightful little shop that sells these delightful olive oils, and there's another woman that sells yarn, and there's a woman that sells paper. And they're just great little boutique shops to be looking for these exciting, specific things.
I think out of the 8 or so shops and restaurants on our street, Kendra, correct me if I'm wrong, probably 6 out of the 8 are women-owned or women-involved with their husbands. I mean, I just really think that's a high percentage for one street. And on the other side, there's 3 for sure out of that side, maybe 4. So, yeah, just on our own little Santa Fe Drive, you know, we have quite a percentage, high percentage of women, high involvement.
And that all happened just by accident. It's not that they...
Some of us, yeah, by accident. Some of us, you know, kind of saw a job and applied for it and got it. You know, I mean, it's like, wow, there's all sorts of opportunities. And I checked out 2 other business-owned women opportunities online before I chose doing the olive oil store. Back in 2009. So, yeah, so I did look elsewhere. I didn't just consider this one, but out of the 3, this seemed to fit me the best.
I just think it's a wonderful, it kind of goes against what we expect from society, and that women aren't getting this equal participation in so many places. And then you have this wonderful little spot in Overland Park where women are just, you know, taking over.
Years ago, well, I joined the financial services industry, and there still are very few women in it. But I learned from attorneys who weren't getting promoted into partnerships that being a sole proprietor, they could control their own destiny. It's so valid for women. So many women entrepreneurs out there because it's a way they can have a workplace that works for them and isn't... hostile.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of a natural outgrowth. And I think, I don't know, I can't remember, but I'm thinking that largely women own a heck of a lot of businesses in this country and are big employers. But I don't remember the statistics.
Yeah. I'm just going to assume that since you've been working for yourself, no one's ever passed you up for a promotion because you were a woman, but they told you it was because they found a better fit or some other sort of nonsense. You've just gone right up to the top of your own thing and said, you're not going to tell me what I can't do.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me in my stage of life here, I think it's I can only put it this way. It's a really big blessing in my life. Yeah. I'm enjoying it. It's probably the most fun job I've ever had, you know, because, I don't know, just because it seems like a good fit. And I think if a strong woman feels like something's a good fit for her, she should have no reason not to seek to try to fulfill her goal.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just love that advice.
And that's the Tasteful Olive, next door to 10,000 Villages in downtown Overland Park. And what is your address, Jean?
7945. Santa Fe Drive.
And do you have a website or anything?
Yeah,
people
just
want to get more information.
TheTastefulOlive.com.
TheTastefulOlive.com. Well, I really appreciate your coming in and talking to us about all of these wonderful things that you can cook and these. It was a wonderful conversation.
Well, we don't get to talk. We haven't talked about cooking very much on Every Woman.
Well, it seems like such a stereotypical woman thing to do that you shy away from it, and then it's, well, once we get talking
but we
to
all
it, well,
like
I
to
really
eat.
Like that food, and I do like to talk about this, and I do like sharing recipes, and I do like hearing about these things.
And, you know, while we're talking about business and promoting it, I had kind of an insight the other day. Everybody talks about how important social media is, and I've just had social media up to my eyeballs. And I don't know, how do you women feel about social media in promoting 10,000 Villages and the Tasteful Olive?
I use Facebook, but that's the only one I'm doing right now, and I find it's very helpful. But Facebook has its little ins and outs and changes, too, so that in trying to make sure everybody sees your post, sometimes you have to pay a little extra to do a little extra boosting, they call it.
Oh,
so that's kind of changed since I started
with
it.
Yeah, they're tricky. They change pretty frequently, too.
That would be, they change, and it just leaves me way behind and annoys the heck out of me. And of course, they went public, and that would be, now they got to make money, so they got to make everything difficult or... I don't know.
It's frustrating. It can be frustrating.
But Facebook, and I saw there's Tumblr and Instagram.
Oh, there's so many. Pinterest.
And what else?
Twitter.
Yeah, there's so
how
many.
How do you keep up with it? You'd have to hire a full-time person or two full-time people just to keep you in all the social media.
Well, people should just, you know, kind of keep in contact with us so that they know what, you know, things we're doing. We've got like an off-site event coming up this week in South Overland Park. You know, we've got our classes. We've got partnering with all the other stores and art galleries in our area on third Friday nights, you know, to be open till 9. I guess I can say that.
Oh, that's
good.
And,
you know, people just need to click onto our website so that they can see what we're doing or come to the store and get a flyer.
And I know a few times there's been live music out there and it's been kind of a party atmosphere to just go.
So, I mean, they just need to, if they're interested, you know, keep looking for us.
Did you tell us your hours?
Right now we're in holiday hours, just like Kendra mentioned. It's Monday through Friday, 10 to 6, normally speaking. Saturday, 10 to 5:30. But this weekend, we have some extra hours tonight, last night, and the night before. And then we're open on Sundays, 1 to 4, through the holiday here, too.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show today. And I think that you made probably all of our listeners very hungry. And I look forward to...
I may be making a side trip tomorrow.
Yeah, that was about right. I look forward to trying.
I was kind
of
excited about those Sunday hours. Yeah. Well, thanks to Kendra Frank, manager of 10,000 Villages, and to
Jean McKay.
Thank you. Of
the Tasteful Olive.
Thank you.
And the woman business owner of the year, and that's an exciting thing to be too. And we congratulate you on that. And stay tuned for Urban Connections coming up next.
Followed by Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City.
Fantastic.
Funding for KKFI provided by the Weekly Forum at All Souls UU Church this Sunday, November the 17th. Bernard Franklin will talk about why can't the richest nation on the planet get education right? How is it that the richest nation has one of the most broken educational systems in the world? All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org. Listen to the All Souls Forum each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on 90.1 FM KKFI.